This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. Hello and welcome to Allegro Non Troppo.
I'm Peter Forty. Allegro Non Troppo is presenting three programmes this month to look at the stories of war in the lead-up to our National Day of Honouring Our Armed Forces on April the 25th, Anzac Day.
We have the highest respect for people who have fought to defend their country.
As much as we all abhor involvement in war, it has been a constant consequence of human endeavour.
As time goes on, the threat of another world war seems to be more and more remote. Perhaps people living in the 1920s thought like this also.
Local campaigns such as those in the Middle East and wars delivered by terrorism are more likely to be the way war is waged now and in the future.
War machines are now sanitised. Hand-to-hand combat with bayonets is a thing of the past. Members of the armed forces are the most remarkable examples of people willing to die or commit unbelievable acts for their fellow countrymen.
The First World War was one of the bloodiest encounters. Ghastly tales of suffering and death still linger.
The Second World War was the first with modernised technology on land, sea and in the air.
The war in the air was terrible and magnificent. The flying machines unleashed destruction on huge areas of Europe and Asia.
The stories of the people who flew these machines are fast fading as their generation dies out.
Author Michael Veitch has captured some of these amazing stories of the men and women who carried the war into the air in his books Flak and Fly. He joins us today.
Hello, Michael Veitch. Welcome to the Community Radio Network.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Lovely to be here.
Michael, these books that you've written are really quite amazing. I've read Fly, although actually I got the audiobook version, which was rather remarkable because it was great to hear you reading it and expressed as you did. It's available on the internet if people want to have a look at it.
Bolinda Audio are the publishers that do that. Yes, and it's readily available, I believe, as well. Yeah.
Both of these books, Flak and Fly, are to do with the lifelong obsession you've had. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about this obsession.
Well, it's as I say in the book, it's one of those things that's felt like a kind of a companion that's walked with me through the kind of course of my life, and I guess a kind of a childhood interest that, unlike a lot of childhood interests didn't fade away like some do, but kind of stayed with me into adulthood, and here it is, and it really stemmed from a fascination with. The times, I was, you know, people say when I was a kid, oh, you were born in the wrong time. You were kind of, you know, you should have been born in the 20s or something like that. And I never really agreed with that. I never really understood that. But I nonetheless did feel an affinity with, as a kid, with people much older than myself. And I really did enjoy talking to people who participated in the great events of 39-45. And that interest sort of honed itself down to an interest in aeroplanes and flying, and by logical step, I suppose, I was always interested in hearing the stories of the people who were in the Air Force and flew aeroplanes in the Second World War. You know, fast forward, no pun intended there, many years later, and my very dear friend and journalist Peter Wilmoth, formerly of The Age newspaper in Melbourne, was writing the biography of actor Bud Tingwall. And Bud was a Spitfire pilot. He was a He was a Spitfire photo reconnaissance pilot in the Second World War.
I never knew that.
Yeah, and Peter would ring me and say, "Look, I'm talking to Bud, and he's we're talking about his flying days, and he keeps talking about like a PRU and a 20mm this and a Mark 9, and I don't know what he's talking about." So well, you know, I'd explain. Well, PRU is a photo reconnaissance unit, and a 20mm, that's the cannon. All this technical stuff. And I remember thinking, oh, I should write my own bloody book about these old fellas. So I contacted Peter's publisher, Pan Macmillan, and with an embarrassment of ease, really, it came about that I just submitted a very short a submission to the publisher, one Tom Gilliatt at Pan Macmillan. And he said, yeah, it's a good idea. And all I proposed is really just finding fellas that had flew in air crew. That's my only criteria, was that they had actually been in the air. I didn't mind if they were pilots or navigators or rear gunners, on whose side they fought. And people who preferably hadn't really told their story much before. So there began this kind of odyssey where I, by various organic methods, illogical, often exploiting my media contacts, Bert Newton, in fact, helped me just to track these people down. I just, if I can digress slightly, I was in a play, and the producers of the play had managed to score about 10 minutes on the Bert's Good Morning Australia show, where I was supposed to talk about the play. The day before, I had a chat with a producer, and she said, "Oh, is there anything else you're doing?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm doing this book where I want to talk to old blokes who flew in aeroplanes." And she went, "Oh, yes, that sounds interesting." And I think Bert and I, and Bert was keen on the idea too. And I'll never forget the picture of this poor beleaguered producer of this play that was a flop, by the way, in the wings, as Bert and I spoke for, I think, 9.5 out of the allotted 10 minutes about why I'm doing this book and what my interest is and the sort of people that should contact. And I, that morning, I actually just invented it. I put up a kind of a web address and an email address and a phone number, and they flashed that up. And the poor producer, "Talk about the play, talk about the play," thinks.
Goodness gracious.
But that began a kind of a method by which people directly contact me and say, "Well, actually, I was a Lancaster pilot, and I was a gunner in Halifax's, or I was in Sunderland's, or I flew up in the islands, Hudson's for a while." And I had this huge list of people, and some of them were not appropriate. Some of them hadn't actually done enough for me to write about.
The thing that impressed me reading or listening to your book, Michael Veitch, was the fact that many of them actually started to write their own memoirs. Because they were aware of their own mortality.
Absolutely.
And these incredible experiences they went through are going to disappear when they go. So many of them were aware that their stories probably really did need to be recorded for posterity. Not only just for the fact that they're bloody incredible stories, but they're also some incredible acts, and the book has really struck a chord with me. But I just wanted to have a little look and a little exploration of yourself as, why did this not become a career? Why did you end up being a comedian, a presenter and everything else, yet not a historian? If this was such a chronic obsession for you.
Look, it is and it's not. I mean, I actually find a lot of military history rather dull, to be honest. I find it very written in a kind of a pedestrian, technically based kind of method that I found very kind of enervating and a bit kind of, it didn't capture the kind of human stories. I think it's because, Adam, I come from a family of journalists as well, and I love stories and I love storytelling. I never had the discipline to be an academic.
Okay.
Neither the desire nor the discipline.
Okay.
But I did like telling stories, and this is just an extension of that.
And it's certainly some great stories. I understand, and particularly stories of the First and Second World War. I remember when I was about 6 or 7 years old, my great-grandfather trying to explain to me what he was doing in Northern Africa. And, you know, I was thinking, Doctor Who's on, why am I listening to this? And now I think back and think, I wish I'd listened,
yes.
Because my father sort of vaguely remembers the stories as well from my great-grandfather.
But they're gone, aren't they?
They're gone.
They're gone, yeah. Well, look, and so many times I've had people say, "Oh, you know, Dad, he'd never talk about it. Granddad, he'd never talk about it. And I used to say, "Well, did you actually ask him? Did you really know how to ask?" I mean, I think I say in maybe the first or the second book, these fellas hated, it's that generation, those direct kind of questions never kind of, you know, they always found them a bit confronting. Like, open-ended questions are terrible for people of that generation, especially men of that generation. You can't just ask someone, "So what did you do with the war?" Because they'll just say, "Oh, nothing."
Right.
But if you ask them, "What date did you join up?" They'll say, 3rd of March, 1941. And they say, "Okay, and with the Air Force fellas, What was your where did you go? Bradfield Park for elementary flying training, then number 23 operational training unit, and it's all there. It's all in their head still, and so many times no one had actually gone there and just in
coaxed
a linear
the story
kind of way.
Out of them. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just, and I had no trouble. And it's only getting their stories out of them, and I presented it to them as a kind of a project, as a kind of a timeline that needed to be filled in.
Yes.
And very reluctantly, I think, did they skip anything?
Okay. My grandparents, I've got quite a number of grandparents. Most of them are dead. They're all dead now, actually.
Right.
But some German ones as well. And the stories that they've told me, and the British ones, they were on Tyneside. They were around the River Tyne where there were a lot of docks, and it was very heavily bombed
very
by the Germans.
So, yeah.
And the stories that they've told me. But if I'd asked them, they would never have told me.
No.
But the fact that they just told me because I'm a relative, and those stories are just with me. I think about them even 50 years later. I'm still thinking about some of those stories. They're just remarkable, very much like the stories in your book. When you did the first book, Flak, we know what flak is. That's the shrapnel from exploding air shells.
Yes.
What was the impetus? What was the inspiration for you to write that book? Was it the same thing? I haven't read Flak. Is it the same as Fly?
It's pretty much the same. There's more in the second book. I really wanted to do the second book because there were so many of the fellas that I'd interviewed that I'd missed out just for space reasons in the first book, and there was I felt I didn't want to finish the project without talking to a Sunderland pilot. Now, Sunderland was a big flying boat. It was my favourite aeroplane of the Second World War. It's
really?
Big, lumbering, white, painted.
I thought it would have been a Lancaster.
I did love. I do love the Lancaster. That's true.
Or the Halifax. Oh, I do remember in your book also saying that you did crowd into a DC-3 to fly across Melbourne in the sunset.
That's
and
right.
You were quite bitterly disappointed by the experience. Something magnificent about those old flying machines is they do look fantastic from the outside.
But inside they're very cramped and like, oh, Dad, I'm not sure about this. That was the wonderful Goonie bird that flies over in the summer months over Melbourne, and someone shouted me a passing it. But I always got much more pleasure from watching it from the ground. But back to the impetus of the first book. Yes, really, it was just a kind of a culmination of a very long-held desire, I think.
Okay. They are remarkable stories. I did want to talk to you about a couple of the stories, but I just wanted to perhaps play a little bit of the audiobook so our listener does get a little bit of gets an image of what it's like to have you reading the book, but also some of the things and some of the elements. And I think this 1 minute audio grab sort of encapsulates. It tells us how much time has passed since these events happened and since we're now hearing them.
64 years after the event. Never, though, he says, has he actually spoken to anyone about the war in such detail and perhaps with such honesty. He apologises for his bluntness in critiquing my own work earlier, but I assure him I'm truly grateful and that it is his candour I've come to hear. Even now, it's rare for me to meet a former flyer so willing to talk about the fear that he and others underwent, a fear that I, with half a lifetime of obsessive imaginings, cannot even begin to comprehend. Then he pays me perhaps his greatest compliment. I think it's admirable what you're doing. Most of us fellas are at the age now when we're going to die fairly soon. After that, the real stories are gone forever. You were there to fight a war. You were there to kill as many people as you could. You were there to do as much damage as you could. You were there to do all the things that horrify you as you look back. Horrify you as you look back.
Michael Veitch, that sound of the air raid siren was a terror for a whole generation.
Yes. The fellow I was talking to there was Nevin Philby, and he would have heard the air raid sirens a lot. He was in the 2nd Tactical Air Force, which were the kind of a... They were an odd group, the TAF. They were kind of a bomber boy equivalent of the fighter pilot. They were formed relatively late in the war, and they were a kind of really the forerunner of the Army Corporation kind of quick strike air force. They flew Mitchell aeroplanes B-25s in Europe, and if something was, if the army needed something to happen quick, like in like literally in half an hour, if the army, you know, if the army was pushing up through Europe, and the general listened that there's a bridge across a river that we can't get past, it's too heavily defended, and we can't take it out, we need an airstrike quickly. That radio back to
the dial and air raid.
In fact, I think I actually
you did. That was the phrase.
Yes, dial and air raid, and it was literally like they were on standby for a phone call to ring, and they had to be on standby. Whereas in the Battle of Britain, these were the fighter guys that were on standby to fly against Spitfires. These were bomber boys, and they had to go up and take out something.
Nevin Philby told a story that is quite remarkable. He had a great deal of respect for the enemy in some ways. And one of the stories that he told me, which completely stuck in my head, because one of my grandparents told me a similar story. And the story that Philby was telling us was that a German fighter came to attack one of the airfields where he was.
Oh, yeah.
And it shot up all the Spitfires, and then there was one in a hangar. So what he did was, to make sure he got the Spitfire, as he was flying towards the hangar and he started firing his machine guns, he started to fishtail the plane so that he could get a wide sweep across. Now, the skill required, and my father flies a plane, and I've been with him, and the skill required to fishtail something like a... what?
When you're about 20 feet off the ground.
Was it a Messerschmitt?
Yeah, it was 109. And that pilot, and if I had my book in front of me, I could tell you, but he was one of the great German aces.
Yeah.
And... he was captured very soon after that, and he was one of these natural pilots that could do anything. The Messerschmitt 109 was a very fine aeroplane, and the later marks towards the end of the war were actually superlative aeroplanes to fly.
One of my great uncles used to fly a 109. I think it was a 109.
Really?
And
okay.
The story he told us was that when he was flying over and he was escorting bombers over London, what he used to do was to line up his guns as they were coming up to some of the seaside towns like Brighton. He used to drop out of the clouds and to line his guns up and make sure he was right, he used to shoot the windows out of the hotels.
Right.
So I don't know how much truth is in that. But this is where it gets really remarkable, because my father was telling this story when they migrated to Australia in 1968, where he was working. And this guy said, you know, he said, I used to live in Brighton.
I used to sit and watch.
He says, and every couple of days when the bombers came over in the afternoon, when they were doing the daytime raids, he said, this one plane used to drop out of the sky, and he says, and I used to watch it come and fly over and shoot out the windows in the hotel.
My goodness.
And I thought, my God, what a small world.
It makes a hair stand on the back of your neck, doesn't it?
Yes. So there were some remarkable, remarkable stories that came out of the Second World War like that. The men who flew these planes, these machines, they unleashed... the bombers in particular, they unleashed incredible devastation across Europe and Asia, particularly across Europe. Mm. I mean, the blitzkrieg that fell on London, and then the retaliation, the aerial bombardment of places like Magdeburg and Dresden were remarkable. My grandmother was telling me some of the most horrific stories in the northern part of England. One particular day, or night, there'd been a particularly severe air raid, and the all clear went, and it was about 9 o'clock in the morning. And what had happened, there was a squadron had actually stayed really high above the clouds, and they came down apparently for daylight, and they tried to bomb the ship, one of the ships that was in the dry dock or in the dock. And they missed, and the bombs fell on the marketplace. Mm. And not everybody had evacuated the air raid shelter. And they bombed the entrance so badly that they couldn't get it out, and it was flooding. And so they sealed it up. So those people died inside the air raid shelter with the bomb falling on it. And at the same time, my other grandmother, not to be outdone, was actually in Dresden the night. I think there was something like 1,000 bombers came over.
Yes, very.
It was saturation bombardment. Yeah. They didn't bother trying to target anything. It's just destroy everything.
Yes.
Inside. And she was telling a story when she came out of the shelter. They were actually slightly outside of the town. When she came out of the shelter, they were only little children. She said the thing that they remember the most is walking across the ground. There was so much phosphorus from the bombs that when they ran, their footprints burned there was fire where their feet had been, so that the ground actually burned because of the phosphorus. Just amazing stories.
So you're half German or...
No, English.
English.
But we've got German ancestors. We've got relatives.
Goodness me, I'd like to be at Christmas Day at your place.
No, actually, it's quite interesting, Michael Veitch. The families don't talk to each other at all.
Funny about that.
Yeah. On both sides, there's quite... But these are, this is just typical of the sorts of things that you've explored in Flack and Fly. Yes. Michael, I'd like to ask you, when you were interviewing these people, it was difficult to get the stories out of them. Did there seem to be some sense of immediacy that you gathered that they wanted to tell their stories?
Oh, very much so, yeah? Adam. I mean, all these people are old. You know, and all the fellas I spoke to were blessed with good memory. I think of my poor old father, who didn't really even make it to 80, and the last 5 years of his life he was gone to me. He was in terrible dementia.
Mm.
But these fellas have beaten the odds, and they've remained lucid and interested and engaged, and a feeling that, look, I did these incredible things in my youth, and if I don't tell someone, they'll just go to the grave with me. So, and that's why I think there's less of a reluctance to actually talk about it with a lot of the people of this generation than there has been, because they're at the end of their life.
Our interview today is with Michael Veitch, author of Fly and Flack. We've been talking to him about some of the aspects of his book and the interviews that he conducted while researching this. Michael Veitch, these pilots and the people who flew in the Second World War, how much fear did you detect in them when they... Did they speak much about fear? 'Cause would have been terrifying.
Terrifying beyond any real comprehension, for me anyway. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, you can only do when you're young.
Mm.
You know, I mean, that's why I actually think one of the reasons that they wouldn't accept fighter pilots beyond the age of about 25 is that it's not the reflex level. I mean, they can often, you know, remain with you sometimes until your early 30s. But it's a realization that what you're doing is so dangerous that any older and you just wouldn't be able to do it. You'd realize, this is just, I can't keep doing this, I'm going to get killed. But it's that immortality of youth that really is the greatest kind of protection against it.
I could imagine myself doing something like that, say when I was 17, 19, maybe 20, but
after that
I think I'd probably be too aware of what it all meant.
Can you condition yourself to not be afraid, do you think? I mean,
well, I think they had to. It's amazing what you can actually suppress. And I actually think the worst fears would have been for the guys in the bomber crews, because there was this terrible inevitability about what you were doing. At various stages of the war, to complete a tour of 30 operations, you had a 1 in 3 chance of survival.
Oh my goodness!
1 in 3, so you are twice as more likely to die than not. Now, how do you carry on doing your job? I have no idea how any of them.
Can I answer that? I answer that. I know from my own personal experience, there comes a point when the fear is so gripping, you realize that if I allow this fear to consume me, I will not survive, and I won't be able to do the things I need to survive. And I'm able to. I have at times of great. When I've had great fear, being able to actually put that fear behind me and not acknowledge it and get on with what I had to do. And that's what I imagine that these men must have done.
Yes,
they would have had to do that. It's not easy to do. You've got to have great reasoning skills.
And it's a cliche, I suppose, but that the bonding and the camaraderie often, and the fear of letting down the people that you are so close to working with in going through this incredible experience, the fear of letting them down often eclipsed the fear of death itself. There's one story in the first book that I spoke about and I'm not sure if it was a direct story. This is a story that had been passed on secondhand. he was bailing out of a doomed Lancaster somewhere in France or Germany. The plane wasn't going down fast because they obviously, because this, he was a mid upper gunner, and he had a chance to actually get to the escape, get over this main spar, the main wing spar, climb over this wing spar, get to the rear escape door and jump out. And as he was jumping out, he saw the he must have been the navigator, because he saw the mid upper gunner waiting by the door, and he saw that, and then you couldn't hear anything because it was too noisy, but he saw the gunner and was like, well, are you going to go ahead of me? But the guy just sort of said no, and pointed back towards the rear gunner's hatch, and so this fella jumped out, and then he realized later the two gunners were not going to be separated. There was some problem. The rear gunner couldn't get out of his turret, but his mate, the mid upper gunner, was not going to leave him, even if it meant dying.
Oh, goodness.
So he just went down with the aeroplane. He refused to bail out. He couldn't leave his friend, who he'd trained. And this fellow knew that these two were very close.
So he went down with his friend.
He went down with his friend.
I guess due to the circumstances that they were living in and living under, it must have formed some incredible friendships, some incredible bonds between
those
guys.
That we can't imagine. These friendships formed in endurance in times of adversity are very, very special.
We see that all around us, though, elements of that all around us society today.
Well, under the terrible fires in Victoria, you know, I mean...
Absolutely. Which were on a couple of months ago,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the friendships formed within these CFA strike teams are often very enduring and very special.
A special guest on Allegro Non Troppo today is Michael Veitch. We're talking about his books Fly and Flak and the experiences with people around him. Michael Veitch is our special guest on Allegro Non Troppo today. We're talking about his two books, Fly and Flak, and the experiences of interviewing these people who are stories he's telling in his book. Some of the stories, Michael, are quite incredible in the acts of aeronautics and the acts of friendship, camaraderie. Some of them are also quite horrifying and terrifying. One of the stories that particularly struck a chord with me as being unbelievable thing to go through was one of the bombers was shot down over Germany, and it landed outside of a town or a village, and a mob of angry people came out. Can you recount part of that story for us?
Yes, this is a story. My friend was a mid upper gunner in a Lancaster. He had a sort of two 303 machine guns mounted on a Perspex turret on the back of the aeroplane, so he had a very good view. And this plane was hit by flak very badly over a major German city. I think it was Essen, actually. And the aeroplane was doomed. And he managed to bail out. Almost all the crew managed to bail out. And he came down, but they knew the consequences of bailing out over a populated area were often very dangerous. He bailed out, and as he was coming down, he realized that he was coming down in the middle of the people he'd been bombing, and it was a daylight operation as well. And he landed in a field. He'd broken his femur falling from the top turret onto the floor of the aeroplane, and he was immediately set on by people hitting him, by a group of civilians, punched and kicked and spat on him. The women pulled his boots off because it was winter and they didn't have any clothes. His parachute was set upon because it was silk, very expensive material. And he knew he was about to be kicked to death or hacked to death. And he was rescued by an old sort of German Home Guard soldier from World War I who said, no, this is not right. He has to be taken to the authorities. He put him into a cart and carted him off to those authorities, and he was saved. All but one of his crew suffered the fate of being lynched and died very horrible deaths after they'd bailed out.
You like Bach, Michael Veitch?
I do love Bach very much.
I love the mathematical consequence of his music. Yes. So mathematical and so precise.
Yes. I just like his tunes, I have to say. He could stitch a good tune together, that fella. He really could.
No variation in tempo, no expressive quality, yet the feeling comes out through its mathematical precision.
Well, have you sat through the St. Matthew Passion?
Yes, I think that's a bit too easy, actually, Adam. I think there's so much, you know. I think passion is the word in things like the St. Matthew. It's beautiful. It's heartrending, you know. Oh, I don't know. There is a lot softy. Of the math. I am. I'm a big softy.
I'm a hard-faced bitch myself, and I quite like being so. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network with Adam and Peter. A special guest today is author and media personality Michael Veitch. We're talking about his two books, Fly and Flack. We were hearing just before our music track of a very sombering episode where a bomber had been shot down in the over a village. In fact, it was shot down over a town that they'd been bombing. And the crew that survived, all except one, were lynched by the people. Look, it's a horrible story, but you sort of understand, don't you?
Well, you know, even the fella that survived, but who lost a lot of his crew, with incredible magnanimity, he didn't actually bear any ill will towards the people.
Couldn't really.
He said, you know, we were destroying we'd done the same thing in London. It happened to German pilots during the Blitz. In fact, there's an awful story of a Polish pilot who was actually flying with the RAF, but they thought he was German because he had a funny accent, and they killed him.
Oh,
in London, they chucked a rope over or just kicked him to death. They didn't believe him.
Mm.
But he said, look, and they were told, listen, you come down in a populated area, it's really not pretty. And a lot of pilots were killed.
It's probably some of the stories that we don't hear, but I should imagine that it happened a lot.
But his telling of this was a very big moment in his life, you know. He really, and I could tell that we were gearing up for something. Because he hadn't told it in the way that he told me for many, many years. Perhaps not ever. But it was the thing I was talking about before, him feeling that, well, you know, posterity is something that is that I believe is important and that should be respected. And I'm not going to be able to tell this story for much longer.
Mm.
And so he told it to me really honestly. It was very emotional for him, very emotional. And I kind of felt the responsibility. Like, the journey of doing these books kind of changed from one of just getting a whole bunch of stories that kind of excited me to, in a way, being the kind of repository of
the guardian of
a lot of very painful and delicate memories for these people's lives, the most significant events that had happened in their lives sometimes.
What do you think is in these stories for us, Michael Veitch?
Well,
A sense of wonderment and amazement at the acts that happened and the machines that were created.
Surely, yes.
But also a reflection of what like.
Yes.
Could it happen today? Would we do the same thing? My great-grandfather telling me in graphic detail of bayonet fighting during the First World War.
Yeah.
And then the Second World War, these incredible machines that were created. The people that committed these acts... It's very difficult to be, and I don't want to sound judgmental because I have such huge respect for people who would fight to defend their country and protect our ways of lives. But what acts did they commit? How did they feel about it?
And what effect did it have on them? I mean, I don't, you know, years ago I read something somewhere that when you kill another person, you change fundamentally. You cannot be the same person that you were before. It's simply impossible. Something almost in your physiological makeup alters. And I can't imagine it's a change for the better either.
The way that war is waged, and unfortunately it just seems to be a consequence of human history, and it's going to be a human future as well. That war is going to be inevitable until we enlighten our whole civilization and the whole human way of thinking. It's not going to change in the near future.
No.
And the way war is waged now, it seems to have polarized. It's more horrible on one aspect, yet it's completely sanitized at the other extreme. We have war which is waged by terrorism now, which is awful because it's war that's waged generally on civilians, not for the sake that they're surrounding military targets, just for the sake of bloody-mindedness.
Yes.
And trying to make a point. And then we have war on the other hand, which is just incredibly technological. I mean, the war that's fought by countries using this incredible technology, it's amazing. I mean, when you look at things like the Gulf War, for example, days before the Gulf War started and there was any movement of machines and troops, there was the War of the Beams, electromagnetic pulse things and trying to disrupt data networks. If I was going to wage war on another country now, I wouldn't worry too much about trying to blow up the infrastructure. If you can destroy the data networks, just imagine if there was an electromagnetic pulse blast above Melbourne and all of our computers and all our technology stopped working. We'd be helpless.
Yeah, you would have won. That would need to be game over, wouldn't it?
So the nature of war is changing because the nature of human technology is changing.
I know people are changing. I mean, I can only imagine, I can't imagine what it must have been like for people in those days to face death, either as soldiers or as civilians. It must change them for the rest of their lives.
I mean, I think
nowadays people live a different lifestyle, live things that worry people today, and nothing compared to, I imagine, to what worried people when they're in those situations.
Absolutely, and the hardness of life. Your accent, Peter, where are you from? What part of England are you from?
Leicester.
From where?
Leicester in the Midlands.
Well, I mean, your parents and grandparents' upbringing would be very different.
Absolutely.
That part of England was pretty tough.
Well, luckily I didn't live in Coventry, which was pretty heavily bombed.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, yeah.
That was one of the first examples of saturation aerial bombardment.
Yes. Both the fellas I spoke to in Fly, because I speak to two Germans in Fly, both bombed Coventry.
Mm.
Both were on Operation Moonlight Sonata, they called it, much to, I say, Beethoven would be rolling in his grave, but nonetheless, that's what they called it. Both of them, that was their first big 1,000 bomber raid. Everything that could fly was put onto Coventry that night.
What was in Coventry?
Well, apart from the cathedral.
That's all that remained,
Austin,
I think.
That was Oxford. There was a big motorworks at Coventry. There was some industrial...
Yeah, I think there was something worth bombing anyway.
But know, at that particular time when this was happening, it was we could see the precursor of modern warfare, the V1s and the V2s. Were they doodle bugs?
Yes, the
V1s. The V1s. What they were, they weren't actually guided missiles so much. They were an early precursor of guided missiles. They had 1,000 pounds of explosive in them.
Yes.
They were just like miniature...
They were kind of guided. Yeah, they were sort of guided.
Didn't they just
guided.
Point them in the direction that they had to go, and then when they ran out of fuel, they would drop?
Gyroscope, yes. They were gyroscopically driven. They weren't accurate. They were very blunt instrument, which is why most of them, I think 70%, were actually shot down before they reached their targets. But the ones that did, oh my goodness.
There was 10,000 of them.
Yeah, no, more. It was a lot.
My mother used to tell me, I think it was doodle bugs, was it, that you'd hear them coming over
and then
you'd
stop.
If they went silent, then...
They sound like brrrr, everyone who heard it says it sounded like a car with a broken muffler in the air.
Mm.
And if you could hear it, it was fine because it was travelling. But then when the motor cut out, it went straight down.
Yeah.
And that's when, if you heard it cut out, there was this ghastly silence and then an explosion. You never knew where the explosion was going to happen. With the V2s, which were virtually went into space and then came down into one big arc, they were unstoppable. I don't think any were brought down. The only thing that stopped them was the end of the war.
One of the things the British did, which actually deflected a lot of the V2s, is when they were reporting in the paper where the V2s had hit, they actually falsified the reports in the media releases saying that they'd landed in a particular area when actually they hadn't, because the Germans, that was how they knew if they were hitting their target.
Oh, and they would falsely correct them.
Yes, so that most
how
of
ingenious.
So
how
most
cunning.
Of them ended up landing east of London.
Or was it
west of London, because they'd falsified the reports and said these V2 rockets had hit this particular location and they actually hadn't.
They're a sneaky lot, aren't they?
But that's quite brilliant, really, in its ingenuity. Michael Veitch, we're coming to the end of our show today, discussing with you a little bit about your book and Flak and Fly. I wanted to actually now deflect and talk about you. Do you know where you are? This place, this is your radio station, 3JOY. Yeah, a gay and lesbian radio station.
Uh-huh.
One of the things you did early in your career as a comedian is you used to play a gay character with Steve Izard. Tell us about that.
Oh, the...
Flight steward.
Yeah, the flight stewards. Yes.
I told you I was going to put you on the spot at the end of the interview about reinforcing stereotypes in our
community. Yes. Shocking, appalling, guilty as charged, reinforcing sexual stereotypes. Absolutely. But it was fun, though. It was fun. And it was kind of, you know, it was never meant to be mean. It was always... In fact, we had... For ages, I'd get... When I'd fly Qantas, you'd have the person... Oh, it's incredible. Those characters you did. I know people that are just like that. It's just shocking, really. And they'd tell me the inside guy. Occasionally, I'd be bumped up to first class, because that's when domestic still had a first class and a business. But they'd come up and give me some goss and some terminology. You're getting it almost right, but just let me say. And they'd give us all the kind of, you know, and we'd go, oh, yeah, and what happens then? And so when you take off and, low, where do you go and what's the gossip? Well, let me tell you something. So they were great. But I'd never had any serious flack from that. Once in Sydney... In Sydney, they take their feelings very serious in Sydney, aren't they? They take all this very seriously.
Oh, the whole place runs on sex and drugs, from my experience.
Yes, but they're a bit less humour, less of a sense of humour about it, by and large. I think it's very political up there. I'm pretty on too many toes.
Did anybody ask you for a date at all?
No. I mean, to mention, my reply would have been, well, thanks for asking, but. But I'd never get asked for a date. No.
You're listening to Adam and Peter here on Allegro Non Troppo.
If anyone's out there, that's...
Michael Feach, stop flirting. We've got a large audience across Australia today. I'm sure they all know who you are. Right. What's happening in the future, Michael Feach?
I'm still doing the Arts Show on ABC on Sundays on... at 5 o'clock on ABC One.
Book.
I'm doing a book. My lovely publisher, my long-suffering and very patient editor, Kirsten Abbott, God bless her heart, and lovely people at Penguin have commissioned me to do a kind of a travelling across Australia book, which I'm writing, but is going very slowly. Meanwhile, I'm doing a bit of theatre.
You're reinforcing more gay stereotypes in the Countdown Show.
No. I am
careful. This would be defamatory.
I know. No, I'm impersonating the legend that is Ian Molly Meldrum in the production of Countdown, the musical, the stage version of the musical. It's a great show. Brian Mannix, formerly of Uncanny X-Men, has got it up, and it's just like for the people who are old enough to remember Countdown and who were lucky enough to watch it on Sundays, and it's like coming on. We'll be touring Australia throughout 2009, Sydney, Newcastle, Darwin, Perth, I believe, Adelaide.
Okay. Has Molly contacted you at all?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We did it 10 years ago, and Ian didn't want to come along because he just had that awful roast, that very kind of homophobic, you know, that incident at Channel 9
we
had
Sam Newman.
Sam Newman, and that's when Ian left Channel 9. He said, well, I'm not going to put up with this, and nor he should too, because it was awful. And it was a shame because I said, oh, I really want him to come and see him, me doing him, and he wouldn't come. And then Brian came in halfway through the season. Brian came up and he said, oh, just so you know, Molly's in the audience. I said, oh, God, thanks very much. and I picked out through the curtain, and he was sitting there looking very kind of, you know, with crossed arms and with surrounded by an entourage of his mates. And he was looking very kind of dubious about the whole thing, but he'd obviously been dragged along just in a little baseball cap and just looking around him very furtively. And halfway through the performance, he got into it and saw that it was a very generous and very affectionate, and I like to think of a very respectful tribute to him, because he's such an important part of our cultural heritage, Molly, you know, and we're such a bigwig in popular music and blah, blah, blah. So he started almost joining in, almost like heckling me, and so it was me playing him, being heckled by him, being him. It was kind of like a theatrical version of an Escher drawing. It was kind of a bit
goodness.
Weird.
Goodness, that would be great.
But this time around, he's all for it, and he's endorsed it, and the only reason he wasn't there on opening night is because he had a prior engagement at the inauguration of Barack Obama. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Yes, that's how well connected he is.
Oh, gosh.
He passed you up for that, didn't he?
He did. I'm affronted, Peter, and I'm very affronted.
I'll sure to tell him when I see him that you're pissed off with him. Michael Vich, we are doing this series on Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network coming up to Anzac Day. It's an important day for Australians. Could you give us a message to Australia for Anzac Day?
Oh, goodness me, what a responsibility. Yes, remember that wars are basically war. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing, as the old song says. And wars are about people, and no one gets out of a war free. You know, I've spoken to the people who have been through wars, and people should really.
Do you respect them, Michael Vich?
Oh, very, very much so. I respect them, but I respect them for being ordinary as well.
Yeah.
And you know, they all hate the word. The only common thread that these fellas had was loathing the word hero.
Okay.
They made them wince. They hated it, and they hated jingoism as well.
Mm.
And Anzac Day is not about jingoism. It's about remembrance and the recollection of, you know, the kind of dreadful destruction that wars have on people's lives and people's memories and the legacies that they take.
It's about bravery. It's about courage. It's about horror. It's all of those things. All of those things that bring out the best and the worst in human qualities. Michael Vich, it's been great to have you on Allegro Non Troppo. Thank you.
It's been my great pleasure. Thanks, Adam. Okay. Thanks, Peter.
Special guest this week was Michael Vich. You can catch up with Michael Vich on Sunday Arts on the ABC One television. This is Adam and Peter. We'll be back next week with...